Chapter 35. Absence of care and presence of material ease gradually blunted her appreciation of these values, and left her more conscious of the void they could not fill. Maddie Dormer's undiscriminating good nature, and the slapdash sociability of her friends, who treated Lily precisely as they treated each other, all these characteristic notes of difference began to wear upon her endurance. And the more she sought to criticize in her companions, the less justification she found for making use of them. The longing to get back to her former surroundings hardened to a fixed idea, but with the strengthening of her purpose, came the inevitable perception that, to attain it, she must exact fresh concessions from her pride. These, for the moment, took the unpleasant form of continuing to cling to her hosts after their return from Alaska. Little as she was in the key of their milieu, her immense social facility, her long habit of adapting herself to others without suffering her own outline to be blurred, the skilled manipulation of all the polished implements of her craft, had won for her an important place in the Gormer group. If their resonant hilarity could never be hers, she contributed a note of easy elegance more valuable to Maddie Dormer than the louder passages of the band. Sam Dormer and his special cronies stood indeed a little in awe of her, but Maddie's following, headed by Paul Morpeth, made her feel that they prized her for the very qualities they most conspicuously lacked. If Morpeth, whose social indolence was as great as his artistic activity, had abandoned himself to the easy current of the Gormer existence, where the minor exactions of politeness were unknown or ignored, and a man could either break his engagements, or keep them in a painting jacket and slippers, he still preserved his sense of differences, and his appreciation of graces he had no time to cultivate. During the preparations for the Bryce tableau, he had been immensely struck by Lily's plastic possibilities at the face. Too self-controlled for expression, but the rest of her gad, what a model she'd make. And though his abhorrence of the world in which he had seen her was too great for him to think of seeking her there, he was fully alive to the privilege of having her to look at and listen to while he lounged in Maddie Dormer's disheveled drawing room. Lily had thus formed, in the tumult of her surroundings, a little nucleus of friendly relations which mitigated the crudeness of her course in lingering with the Gormers after their return. Nor was she without pale glimpses of her own world, especially since the breaking up of the Newport season had set the social current once more toward Long Island. Kate Corby, whose tastes made her as promiscuous as Carrie Fisher was rendered by her necessities, occasionally descended on the Gormers, where, after a first stare of surprise, she took Lily's presence almost too much as a matter of course. Mrs. Fisher, too, appearing frequently in the neighborhood, drove over to impart her experiences and give Lily what she called the latest report from the Weather Bureau. And the latter, who had never directly invited her confidence, could yet talk with her more freely than with Gertie Farish, in whose presence it was impossible even to admit the existence of much that Mrs. Fisher conveniently took for granted. Mrs. Fisher, moreover, had no embarrassing curiosity. She did not wish to probe the inwardness of Lily's situation, but simply to view it from the outside and draw her conclusions accordingly. And these conclusions, at the end of a confidential talk, she summed up to her friend in the succinct remark, "You must marry as soon as you can." Lily uttered a faint laugh, for once Mrs. Fisher lacked originality. "Do you mean, like Gertie Farish, to recommend the unfailing panacea of a good man's love?" "No, I don't think either of my candidates would answer to that description," said Mrs. Fisher after a pause of reflection. "Either? Are there actually two? Well, perhaps I ought to say one and a half for the moment." Miss Bart received this with increasing amusement. "Oh, other things being equal, I think I should prefer a half-husband." "Who is he?" "Don't fly out at me till you hear my reasons, George Dorset." "Oh," Lily murmured reproachfully, but Mrs. Fisher pressed on unrebuffed. "Well, why not? They had a few weeks honeymoon when they first got back from Europe, but now things are going badly with them again. Bertha has been behaving more than ever like a madwoman, and George's powers of credulity are very nearly exhausted. They're at their place here, you know, and I spent last Sunday with them. It was a ghastly party, no one else, but poor Nettie Silverton, who looks like a galley slave, they used to talk of my making that poor boy unhappy. And after luncheon George carried me off on a long walk, and told me the end would have to come soon. Miss Bart made an incredulous gesture. As far as that goes, the end will never come. Bertha will always know how to get him back when she wants him. Mrs. Fisher continued to observe her tentatively. And not if he has anyone else to turn to. Yes, that's just what it comes to. The poor creature can't stand alone. And I remember him such a good fellow, full of life and enthusiasm. She paused, and went on, dropping her glance from Lily's colon. He wouldn't stay with her 10 minutes, if he knew, Miss Bart repeated. What you must, for instance, with the opportunities you've had. If he had positive proof, I mean, Lily interrupted her with a deep blush of displeasure. Please let us drop the subject, Carrie. It's too odious to me. And to divert her companion's attention, she added, with an attempt at lightness, colon, and your second candidate? We must not forget him. Mrs. Fisher echoed her laugh. I wonder if he'll cry out just as loud if I say Sim Rosedale? Miss Bart did not cry out. She sat silent, gazing thoughtfully at her friend. The suggestion, in truth, gave expression to a possibility which, in the last weeks, had more than once recurred to her, but after a moment she said carelessly, Mr. Rosedale wants a wife who can establish him in the bosom of the Van Osburghs and Treanors. Mrs. Fisher caught her up eagerly. And so you could with his money. Don't you see how beautifully it would work out for you both? I don't see any way of making him see it, Lily returned, with a laugh intended to dismiss the subject. But in reality it lingered with her long after Mrs. Fisher had taken leave. As he had seen very little of Rosedale since her annexation by the Gormers, for he was still steadily bent on penetrating to the inner paradise from which she was now excluded. But once or twice, when nothing better offered, he had turned up for a Sunday, and on these occasions he had left her in no doubt as to his view of her situation. That he still admired her was, more than ever, offensively evident. For in the Gormer circle, where he expanded as in his native element, there were no puzzling conventions to check the full expression of his approval. But it was in the quality of his admiration that she read his shrewd estimate of her case. He enjoyed letting the Gormer see that he had known this Lily. She was this Lily to him now, before they had had the faintest social existence. Enjoyed more especially impressing Paul Morpeth with the distance to which their intimacy dated back. But he let it be felt that that intimacy was a mere ripple on the surface of a rushing social current, the kind of relaxation which a man of large interests and manifold preoccupations permits himself in his hours of ease. The necessity of accepting this view of their past relation, and of meeting it in the key of pleasantry prevalent among her new friends, was deeply humiliating to Lily. But she dared less than ever to quarrel with Rosedale. She suspected that her rejection rankled among the most unforgettable of his rebuffs, and the fact that he knew something of her wretched transaction with Treanor, and was sure to put the basest construction on it, seemed to place her hopelessly in his power. Yet at Carrie Fisher's suggestion a new hope had stirred in her. Much as she disliked Rosedale, she no longer absolutely despised him. For he was gradually attaining his object in life, and that, to Lily, was always less despicable than to miss it. With the slow unalterable persistency which as he had always felt in him, he was making his way through the dense mass of social antagonisms. Already his wealth, and the masterly use he had made of it, were giving him an enviable prominence in the world of affairs, and placing Wall Street under obligations which only Fifth Avenue could repay. In response to these claims, his name began to figure on municipal committees and charitable boards. He appeared at banquets to distinguished strangers, and his candidacy at one of the fashionable clubs was discussed with diminishing opposition. He had figured once or twice at the Treanor dinners, and had learned to speak with just the right note of disdain of the big Van Osburgh crushes, and all he now needed was a wife whose affiliations would shorten the last tedious steps of his ascent. It was with that object that, a year earlier, he had fixed his affections on Miss Bart, but in the interval he had mounted nearer to the goal, while less he had lost the power to abbreviate the remaining steps of the way. All this she saw with the clearness of vision that came to her in moments of despondency. It was success that dazzled her. She could distinguish facts plainly enough in the twilight of failure. And the twilight, as she now sought to pierce it, was gradually lighted by a faint spark of reassurance. Under the utilitarian motive of Rosedale's wooing, as he had felt, clearly enough, the heat of personal inclination. She would not have detested him so heartily had she not known that he dared to admire her. What, then, if the passion persisted, though the other motive had ceased to sustain it? As he had never even tried to please him, he had been drawn to her in spite of her manifest disdain. What if she now chose to exert the power which, even in its passive state, he had felt so strongly? What if she made him marry her for love, now that he had no other reason for marrying her? As became persons of their rising consequence, the Gormers were engaged in building a country house on Long Island, and it was a part of Miss Bart's duty to attend her hostess on frequent visits of inspection to the new estate. There, while Mrs. Gormer plunged into problems of lighting and sanitation, Lily had leisure to wander, in the bright autumn air, along the tree-fringed bay to which the land declined. Little as she was addicted to solitude, there had come to be moments when it seemed a welcome escape from the empty noises of her life. She was weary of being swept passively along a current of pleasure and business in which she had no share, weary of seeing other people pursue amusement and squander money, while she felt herself of no more account among them than an expensive toy in the hands of a spoiled child. It was in this frame of mind that, striking back from the shore one morning into the windings of an unfamiliar lane, she came suddenly upon the figure of George Dorset. The Dorset place was in the immediate neighborhood of the Gormer's newly acquired estate, and in her motor flights thither with Mrs. Gormer, Lily had caught one or two passing glimpses of the couple, but they moved in so different an orbit that as he had not considered the possibility of a direct encounter. Dorset, swinging along with bent head, in moody abstraction, did not see Miss Bart till he was close upon her. But the sight, instead of bringing him to a halt, as he had half expected, sent him toward her with an eagerness which found expression in his opening words. "Miss Bart, you'll shake hands, won't you? I've been hoping to meet you. I should have written to you if I dared." His face, with its tossed red hair and straggling mustache, had a driven uneasy look, as though life had become an unceasing race between himself and the thoughts at his heels. The look drew a word of compassionate greeting from Lily, and he pressed on, as if encouraged by her tone, "I wanted to apologize, to ask you to forgive me for the miserable part I played." She checked him with a quick gesture. "Don't let us speak of it. I was very sorry for you," she said, with a tinge of disdain which, as she instantly perceived, was not lost on him. He flushed to his haggard eyes, flushed so cruelly that she repented the thrust. "Why, you might well be. You don't know. You must let me explain. I was deceived. Abominably deceived." "I am still more sorry for you then," she interposed, without irony. "But you must see that I am not exactly the person with whom the subject can be discussed." He met this with a look of genuine wonder. "Why not? Isn't it to you, of all people, that I owe an explanation?" "No explanation is necessary. The situation was perfectly clear to me." "Ah," he murmured, his head drooping again, and his irresolute hand switching at the underbrush along the lane. But as Lily made a movement to pass on, he broke out with fresh vehemence, Miss Bart, for God's sake don't turn from me. We used to be good friends, you were always kind to me, and you don't know how I need a friend now. The lamentable weakness of the words roused a motion of pity in Lily's breast. She too needed friends as he had tasted the pang of loneliness, and her resentment of Bertha Dorset's cruelty softened her heart to the poor wretch who was after all the chief of Bertha's victims. I still wish to be kind. I feel no ill will toward you, she said. But you must understand that, after what has happened, we can't be friends again, we can't see each other. Ah, you are kind, you're merciful, you always were. He fixed his miserable gaze on her. But why can't we be friends? Why not, when I've repented in dust and ashes? Isn't it hard that you should condemn me to suffer for the falseness, the treachery of others? I was punished enough at the time, is there to be no respite for me? I should have thought you had found complete respite in the reconciliation which was effected at my expense, Lily began, with renewed impatience. But he broke in imploringly, don't put it in that way, when that's been the worst of my punishment. My God! What could I do? Wasn't I powerless? You were singled out as a sacrifice. Any word I might have said would have been turned against you. I have told you I don't blame you. All I ask you to understand is that, after the use Bertha chose to make of me, after all that her behavior has since implied, it's impossible that you and I should meet. He continued to stand before her, in his dogged weakness. Is it needed me? Mightn't there be circumstances? He checked himself, slashing at the wayside weeds in a wider radius. Then he began again, Miss Bart, listen, give me a minute. If we're not to meet again, at least let me have a hearing now. You say we can't be friends after what has happened. But can't I at least appeal to your pity? Can't I move you, if I ask you to think of me as a prisoner you alone can set free? Lily's inward start betrayed itself in a quick blush. Was it possible that this was really the sense of Carrie Fisher's adumbrations? Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.